We are privileged to have with us an outstanding American. He's the author of 5 best-selling books, including the well-known None Dare Call It Conspiracy, which has sold nearly 4 million copies. For more than 10 years, Gary Allen has provided volumes of powerful, penetrating missiles for use by patriots working for Americanism. Massive circulation of reprints of his articles from Review of the News and American Opinion magazines have exposed and destroyed numerous socialist schemes. He is a top authority on the communist deception, subversion, and terrorism facing us in the streets today. He has ripped the mask off of so-called academic freedom from the totalitarian mental diet being fed students in most colleges and universities. The think tanks, socialist planners, media mongols, tax-free foundations, international bankers, and world government oligarchists are just some of those whose nefarious schemes have been exposed by the typewriter of Gary Allen. Perhaps it was at Stanford University, where he played tackle and majored in history and English, that Gary developed the ability to tackle an immense issue, reduce it to its fundamental essence, and present it in understandable language. Nowhere has he better demonstrated this ability than in his newest book, The Rockefeller File. Everybody knows the Rockefellers are rich. Everybody knows they have tax-free foundations. And everyone knows they have political power. Yet very few people realize, and fewer still are able to lucidly demonstrate, what the Rockefellers are using their money, foundations, and political power to achieve. This Gary Allen does with distinction in his new book. And this he is going to do tonight by giving us some glimpses of what he has found through his research and investigations. It's an honor to introduce Mr. Gary Allen.
Thank you very, very much. We're going to talk a little bit about my book on the Rockefellers, and start by talking about, well, why is this book any different? You know, there have been literally hundreds of books written on the Rockefeller family. You can go down to the library, and they've almost got a big library like the Los Angeles County Library. They've almost got a whole room full of books on the Rockefellers. Some are written by people who are very anti-Rockefeller. Some are written by people who were commissioned by the family to write books. But my book is a little bit different. There's even a new book out by a guy who's had quite a bit of publicity, a fellow named Ferdinand Lundberg, whose new book is called The Rockefeller Syndrome. It's a $14 hardback, and Mr. Ferdinand Lundberg has been all over the country, appearing on all the radio programs, discussing his book. And his book is full of a tremendous amount of research, and it's sort of like telling a joke and leaving the punchline out, because he spends literally hundreds of pages documenting the fantastic power of the Rockefeller family, how its interlocks go into virtually every phase of American life, the economic power they have, the power in the media, and then he leaves it right there. And I've heard him interviewed on radio programs, and the broadcaster will say, well, Mr. Lundberg, do you think the Rockefellers are dangerous? And here he spent something like 1,400 pages categorizing all of this stuff, and he sort of says, well, I don't know, they might be. They've got a lot of potential for power there, and they just might someday misuse it. Well, my book is not quite like that. I dispose of the economic power and the interlocks in the first 2 or 3 chapters. I mean, I really feel that once you've read about all the different people on the different boards of directors who are connected with the Rockefeller family or with the Chase Manhattan Bank or Standard Oil, there's just so much of that you can take, and any more of that you're going to want to go beat your head against the wall. What I think is important is that the Rockefellers, one, we show that they are very well organized, and two, that they have a plan. And they are following that plan. And this is what Lundberg, despite his enormous amount of scholarship, leaves out. The plan is called the New World Order. And we'll be discussing that in pretty great detail tonight. Let me start with sort of a capsule that I think is almost worth memorizing as to the name of the game that the Rockefellers are playing. Now this, I will begin by saying that it's an oversimplification, because I'm going to give you a chain here in a minute, and a lot of these things were actually going on simultaneously, but while this is an oversimplification, it is not a distortion of what the Rockefellers have done. They started off, they made a lot of money. Some of that money they made honestly. A lot of it they made through tactics, which can be summarized as two types of tactics. One was just dirty tricks, and the other was bribing government officials. But the original Standard Oil Trust was a very, very efficient business organization. But anyway, the Rockefellers, they started out, they made money. They took money, and the next link in the chain was they used that money to gain a very strong influence in the mass media. The next link in the chain was that using the influence they had in the mass media, that gave them a strong impact on public opinion. The next link, when you have strong impact on public opinion, you're going to be able to affect the outcome of elections. And of course, when you can affect the outcome of elections, you can have a lot of politicians in your pocket. When you control politicians, you then gain control of the government, obviously. And today, now that we have virtually merged or married the government with business, when you control the government, you gain control over the next link, which is the economy. And when you control the economy, you're back to having the ability to make enormous amounts of money. So you can see that the chain goes full circle. You start with money. Money, you gain control of media. Media, you gain control of public opinion. With control of public opinion, you gain control of politicians. This gives you control of elections, where you gain control of the government, where you gain control of the economy, where you're back in a position to make more money. If you go out on the street and talk to the average American and you say to him that the Rockefellers are promoting socialism, he thinks that's crazy. Why would the Rockefellers, these multi-billionaires, be for socialism? Good question, isn't it? You see, when I was at Stanford University, I was taught that socialism was a system, an idealistic system. Some professors would say it's what we should work for, and others would say, well, it's idealistic, but possibly it's not practical. But everybody agreed that conceptually it was a wonderful system, because it took from the rich and it gave to the poor. In other words, the theory is that a guy who sweeps the floors should be paid the same as a brain surgeon, that their reward should be equal, and that was idealistic. Well, of course, everybody knows if you set up a society like that, you wind up with janitors performing brain surgery. But socialism, which we were all told was going to redistribute wealth downwards, that's the bait, because that isn't how it works at all. What we have in this country today, and increasingly so, is a little bit of socialism for the poor, a lot of socialism for the super rich, all paid for by the middle class. Yeah, it's a way of redistributing the wealth. You redistribute the wealth from the people who produce it the workers. You redistribute it up to the super rich, who get it because they control government. Socialism, as the Rockefellers use it, is simply a mechanism for extracting money from the working people and giving it to themselves. There are a number of ways in which the Rockefellers are redistributing the wealth upward. One that we're all familiar with is foreign aid. Foreign aid was sold to the American people after World War II as a method to fight communism. And they made what sounded like a pretty good case for it, too. They said, the communists have taken over Central Europe. The communists have taken over China. Now, we've got to stop communism in Western Europe, and in order to do that, we've got to rebuild the war-torn economies of the Western European states. It was sort of ironic that people that were making that case at the highest level in our government, because you remember the foreign aid was called the Marshall Plan, named after General George Marshall. George Marshall did a tremendous amount towards turning Central Europe and China over to the communists that he was now going to save Western Europe from. Remember, he's the guy that came back from visiting Chiang Kai-shek and said, with the stroke of a pen, I demilitarized, disarmed 39 nationalist divisions. Foreign aid was paid for by money taken from American taxpayers, sent to Western Europe, where much of it was used to build up what we now call the multinational corporations, which are owned to a great degree by the Rockefellers. Now, what they did was they took money out of America, they sent it to Europe to build corporations for the Rockefellers so that they could then send goods back into America and put Americans out of jobs. So the Rockefellers don't care if there's high unemployment in the United States because they are internationalists. They have a far different perspective than you and I do. We look at things, most of us, I think, sort of in the sense of, well, we're Americans first. We're not against people from any other country. We wish them well. We don't wish to harm them. But we consider this to be the most important country, and we expect our government to put our interests first. The Rockefellers have a very different view of it. They were born in this country. They were raised here. But they own major businesses in 125 nations around the world. Through the Chase Manhattan Bank, through the various arms of Standard Oil, they're in business in 125 different countries. So if unemployment is up over here, but it's down in France, they don't care. Now, I am not making an argument here for the abolishment of free trade or setting up tariffs or anything like that. But what they're talking about here, it is not free trade to put an American steel worker in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania out of work by taxing him, sending the money to France to build a steel mill over there, which ships steel back to this country cheaper than we can produce it here. That's not free trade. That's just robbery. And much of the Rockefeller empire has been built that way. Another way in which the middle class is taxed to help the Rockefellers is subsidies. They're in all kinds of businesses which receive subsidies from the government. When Nelson Rockefeller was up for the approval as vice president, there were a few very timid congressmen who sort of brought up this thing about, isn't there somewhat of a conflict of interest here with you owning so much in your family and business in 125 countries around the world? When you make a decision, should you ever become president, isn't this going to be a conflict of interest? And Nelson killed the whole thing with a statement of, Well, gentlemen, if you think that I'm that type of man that would do something like that, that's just a decision you'll have to make. And with that, discussion of it was killed. One thing that did come out during those hearings, it was kind of interesting, was Henry Kissinger. Now, here's Henry Kissinger. He's been around now making foreign policy for the last 6 years, most important man in the administration. He came right off Nelson Rockefeller's private staff. And remember, it came out that when Henry went down to Washington, Nelson laid out 50 big ones on him as a going away present. $50,000 Nelson gave to Henry Kissinger. Now, if you or I gave somebody like that money, what would it be called? A bribe. In Nelson's case, it was simply a humanitarian gift. And yet, Henry Kissinger literally cannot make a decision involving American foreign policy anywhere in the world, including the Soviet Union and Communist China, now known as the People's Republic of China, of course, that is not a total conflict of interest with the Rockefeller family. Now, that $50,000 gift that Nelson had given Kissinger should have got both of them fired. And yet, did you hear any editorials on Channel 4 about this terrible conflict? And remember, this is right after Watergate, when they talked about the rottenness of the government, of people buying politicians. You know, it just depends who's doing the buying. There is a phenomenal double standard here. People don't want to mess with Rocky. If we're going to solve the problem that we have in this country today, we have got to institute divorce proceedings and divorce business from government. Actually, the Democrats have a better view of that, of part of this thing, than Republicans do, because they look at the contracts and the subsidies and they say, well, government is run for big business. Republicans look at it and say, well, government is anti-business. You've got all those alphabet bureaus. You've got OSHA and the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Reserve Board, and all those hundreds of harassment bureaus that the government has. What you have is both sides here are half right. Both are making accurate criticisms, and they're refusing to look at the fact that they're seeing what they want to see and just ignoring what they don't want to see. This is what happens when you marry business and government. Yeah, we ought to get rid of OSHA, but we also ought to stop subsidizing businesses too. Again, the whole idea of the United States government was that the government was neither to help nor to hinder business. There's a bumper sticker I'd like to see put out, and that is, get business out of government and get government out of business. And that way, let's go back to a free economy and let people produce things and not have a gravy train for people who don't work, whether they're rich or poor. See, all of these things concentrate more and more power in government and help to eliminate competition. The Rockefeller family, going back to the original John D. Rockefeller, who said, quote, competition is a sin, end quote, have wanted to eliminate competition. The name of the game is monopoly. It is played by gaining control of government to penalize potential competitors. That is why the Rockefellers are for socialism. I hate to use this corny old cliche about the octopus. You know, everybody's used that. That's really so trite, it's unbelievable. But the Rockefeller family and their holdings really amounts to an octopus. It is the best visual reference I can give you. One brain, lots of tentacles going out. The Rockefellers operate through other people. I mean, there's only four living Rockefeller brothers, and there's only so much that they can do at any one time. And so the four of them have to hire a lot of other people to do their work for them. Now, the Rockefellers, they have a master brain at the top. They got lots of arms going on different directions. Some of the people are tightly controlled, and some of them are loosely controlled. Now, I'd like to discuss this a little bit, because I think that this is very important in how you think about things. And we probably have sort of two groups here in the audience tonight. You've got the people who maybe never been to a speech like this before, and they're out there looking at me now, and they think, geez, I wonder if this guy's got a flying saucer on back. He's sounds like he just dropped in from Mars. And then you've got the people that have been studying this for 15 years, and they're thinking, come on, why doesn't he get around the nitty-gritty and tell it like it really is? If you look at all of the interlocks of the Rockefellers and the connections that they have, it will really escalate your PQ. That's your paranoia quotient. Now, I have a theory on this, and I'd like to see everybody adopt it. I'm sort of a middle-of-the-road paranoid. I look at it that anybody who is less suspicious than I am is naive, and anybody who is more suspicious is paranoid. So, I you know, like the Greeks, I believe in the golden mean. So let me categorize you as group one and group two, the new people and the people who have been studying this for 15 years. Let me talk to you individually. First, those in group one. You know, if you get one of these, you go down to the dime store and you buy one of these puzzles that has 500 separate pieces in it, and you dump it out on the card table, you spread it around, and you throw the box away, and you don't see the picture on the cover of the box, what have you got? Well, you've got 500 little pieces of cardboard that are sort of oddly shaped, and it just looks like a mess, doesn't it? But if you see the picture on the cover, you see that each one of these 500 pieces interlocks with other pieces to form altogether a very coherent picture. Now, what I'm saying to you is that if the American people are not going to continually be conned and conned and conned by the Rockefeller family, operating through different arms and through different Charlie McCarthy's, you can sort of imagine, it's like watching a puppet show, or there's one guy behind there who's doing a lot of manipulating, but they all look independent to you. You don't realize they have any kind of a connection, particularly if somebody doesn't know, for instance, of the existence of an organization like the Council on Foreign Relations, which is sort of the major coordinating committee for the Rockefeller octopus. If you don't know that exists, you don't know that Sam and Tom and Joe and Bob, who all seem to be promoting the same or slightly different things, looks to you like they're just independent guys. When you find out that they are all members of the same fraternity, it makes a difference. So group one, I hope you will read my book, because it is important that you know that the Rockefellers have a plan, and they're working through lots of people, and if you put the pieces together, it's all very coherent. Now, group two. Those of us who have been into this thing for a long time sometimes make the mistake of taking this theory that we are dealing with an organization and that organization has a plan, and we project it too far to the point where we think that every local nasty liberal is somehow a knowledgeable part of a conspiracy. In my opinion, we are dealing, yes, the Rockefellers are involved in what amounts to a conspiracy. And they've got an awful lot of people helping them with this, but very, very few people understand what they're doing. All right, then how do the Rockefellers get people to do this work for them and not know that they're doing it? Very simple. They're working with people who are very ambitious, people who want to get promoted, whether they work in the government bureaucracy, whether they work at NBC, whether they work for the New York Times or United States Steel or the Chase Manhattan Bank. There are a lot of people in there in key positions, and they want to get promoted. All right, ask yourself this. How do you get promoted? Do you get promoted by echoing the ideas, beliefs, and goals of those above you? Or do you get promoted by fighting them? Well, there are a lot of people in the media who have found out that if you start bucking management, pretty soon you're out on the pavement looking for a new job. Let me give you an example, kind of a funny one that I came in contact with. Remember Dave Garroway? He was the original morning show star on CBS. This goes back to the middle-late 50s. Dave Garroway was enormously popular. He phoned me up about 3 years ago, and he'd read my book, None Dare Call It Conspiracy. And he wanted me to come up to Beverly Hills and have lunch with him. And he told me the story of what had happened to Dave Garroway. Dave Garroway's popularity had not diminished, but all of a sudden one day he was fired. And he couldn't figure out why until he read my book. And it turned out that all of the people that were involved in firing him were members of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Rockefeller's invisible government. Now, Dave Garroway was very liberal on domestic issues, but he did not like the Soviet Union. And he was all the time knocking the communists. In fact, I heard him interviewed last December on the Tom Snyder Morning Show. They had they were interviewing a bunch of old celebrities in New York City, and he came right out on the Tom Snyder Show and said, "I got fired because I was so anti-communist." And Dave Garroway, had some jobs after that, Safeway ads and whatnot, but never anything like he had. He was not reflecting the beliefs of the people above him. So it gets down to this. You want to be promoted? You know, to get along, you have to go along. And people have a phenomenal capacity to rationalize if it's for something in their own self-interest. You know, you can see this, whatever your business in, whatever office you're in, you see inter-office politics, don't you? They exist. The higher you go, the more important it becomes. So the Rockefellers get people to go along with what they want, not because there are thousands of conspirators, but because there are thousands and thousands of people who want to be promoted within their field. And if you go along, if you are left-wing, if you are liberal, if you promote that type of thing, good things happen to you. If you fight it, bad things happen to you. And human beings like pleasure and don't like pain. It's as simple as that. John D. Rockefeller started the strategy of infiltrating your competitors. You know, there's nothing quite as advantageous as knowing what the people are doing who you're trying to take over. He was sort of the first Watergater. Well, I guess he probably didn't originate. I guess it probably goes back to Machiavelli or long before that, of taking your people and placing it in an organization. Now you don't have to do that. You, instead of bribing somebody on the board of directors of a competitor, today they just bug the room, don't they? They do it electronically. But John Dee would, he would either have somebody who was secretly working for him put inside a competitor, or he would go bribe somebody. So organizations would have meetings and they would discuss how are we going to stop the Rockefellers from taking over our organization, and the next morning the Rockefellers would know exactly what their strategy was. Pretty nice to have somebody in every organization. That way you don't have alternatives, really. See, now they've done this with our political system, so that today, for all practical purposes, what we have is the Rocka Dems and the Rocka Pubs. The public gets very excited every 4 years when we have an election. They're either Democrats or they're Republicans. Now, let's go back 4 years. We had Hubert Humphrey, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, running against Richard Nixon, who had been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Did the Rockefellers care who won? No, they controlled both candidates. 4 years later, they bring on their guy McGovern, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they still got old Dick Nixon here. But this time, they played a little, an even more clever game. Because out of their sack of Rocka Dems and Rocka Pubs, which they control, they picked the guy who would scare the daylights out of more people than anybody else they could find. They picked this guy who, to the average American, sounds like a maniac. And they put him in front of the microphones and they bring the cameras in on him. And here's this guy, he got a wild look in his eye, and he said, when I'm president of the United States, everybody who can prove they are breathing will get $1,000 a year. And we're going to stop all this stuff of inheriting wealth. Well, people are out there, good grief. And so what do? Well, there's Rockefeller candidate A is stampeding everybody to drown Rockefeller candidate B in money. Richard Nixon soaked up all the money. Now, Richard Nixon didn't have to spend $10 to get elected. Nobody was going to vote for the maniac candidate. Richard Nixon had so much money to spend, he did foolish things like waste a lot of money bugging the Watergate headquarters. Ironically, it cost him his presidential position. There is a difference between the Democrat and Republican parties at the congressional level. There's no difference up here at the presidential level, because those guys are all controlled by the Rockefellers, no matter who's running. But at the congressional level, there's a big difference. But in 1972, the poor Republican who's trying to run for Congress can't raise any money. The reason he can't raise any money is everybody's already given their money to Nixon because they're scared to death of Wild Man McGovern. So Nixon wins big, but the Republicans lose seats in the House. Now, it does not matter to the Rockefellers who wins the presidency. Now, it makes a big difference if you happen to be one of the candidates or one of his friends that's going to get a job. Going back to 68, Nixon wins. Nixon gets to wave at the public. He gets to ride around in Air Force One. He gets all the perquisites. And Hubert Humphrey is back teaching at a little tiny girls' school in Minnesota that nobody's ever heard of. Did it make a difference to Humphrey? Sure. Made a difference to Nixon, too. Did it make any difference as far as the policies? No. Because who came in running the whole foreign policy of the United States? Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger, who had been on the Rockefeller family payroll for over 10 years. Henry Kissinger, who was never even said he was a Republican. Henry Kissinger would have been appointed to exactly the same position if Hubert Humphrey had won. The Rockefellers didn't care whether Humphrey won or Nixon won. They were going to get the key slot no matter who did. Let's go back further. Let's go back to 1960, and Jack Kennedy gets elected. Now, it is becoming very common knowledge these days that Jack Kennedy, to put it delicately, had an active social life. Now, the deal that was made for Kennedy was that he could take the bows, he could enjoy the perquisites, but he wasn't going to run the government. So the key position in the Kennedy administration went to a guy named Dean Rusk. And it was admitted in the papers at the time that Jack Kennedy had never met Dean Rusk. Where did Dean Rusk come from? Well, he came out of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he had just happened to be president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, does it seem logical to you that the President of the United States would appoint somebody to the most important position in his administration to some guy he'd never met? I mean, doesn't that sort of stretch your credulity to the point of snapping it? When Nixon gets in and appoints Kissinger, Time Magazine says Nixon had only met Kissinger once at a cocktail party thrown by Clare Boothe Luce. I just keep, you know, recreate that in your mind. Here's Henry and Nixon. They're standing there with martinis in their hand making small talk at this cocktail party. And here's Henry, who can't even speak English. Yeah, I would like a place in your administration. Can you imagine Nixon giving the key slot in his whole administration to this Dumkopf who he's met at a cocktail party? Why Nixon would have to be crazy to do that. He was obviously told, you appoint Kissinger. That's how appointments are made. They're made paying off the Rockefellers. And Kissinger would have had that same slot had Humphrey been elected. So until Democrats and Republicans see that the puzzle, all the pieces fit together, and what we're looking at is organization and a coherent plan, then we're going to continue to go through this same old thing. The Republicans get conned every time. It's amazing. Going back to 1940, they ran in a guy named Wendell Willkie, and they said, here's this wonderful conservative, Wendell Willkie, and you've got to elect him to stop FDR. So it turned out that Wendell Willkie was part of the Rockefeller group, and he was a big promoter of world government. So 1944 comes along, and they trot out a guy named Tom Dewey. And he, Republican grassroots are told, well, this time, we know you got fooled last time, but this guy is a real article. He's a conservative, and he's going to stop all this socialism. So Dewey tried in 44 and 48. It turned out he worked for the Rockefellers, too, and he was no conservative. So in 52, they take a guy who was about to run as a Democrat. They re-register him as a Republican for the first time in his life. His name is Dwight Eisenhower, and they say, well, we know you were fooled before, but this time this guy is a for real conservative. And he gets elected, and he's, again, part of the Rockefeller group. So He's in for two terms, and 60 comes along, and this time they tried out Dick Nixon. Well, we know that you were fooled a little bit by Dewey and by Wilkie and by Eisenhower, but nobody denies that Nixon is a conservative. He's the guy that got Alger Hiss. So you can all get behind him. So we get two terms of him. And it turns out, he works for the Rockefellers too. The Republican Party reminds me a lot of the character Charlie Brown in Peanuts. You know, I'm sure every red-blooded American reads Peanuts. Every fall, Lucy comes out with a football. And she says, "Charlie, I'm going to hold the football for you, and you kick it." And Charlie's saying, "Well, look, Lucy, the last 14 years, every time I try that, you pull the football away." And Lucy says, "Charlie, honest to gosh, this time, for sure, I promise I am not going to pull that football. This is for real this time." So she holds the football out there, and Charlie gets back, and he takes his run at it, and he swings his leg. She yanks the ball away, and he goes flying up in the air and lands on his back. And for the 15th year in a row, poor old Charlie Brown has been conned. Well, Charlie Brown is the Republican Party, and Lucy is the Rockefellers. And it never seems to fail. The reason it doesn't fail is people just don't make the connections between the candidates and the Rockefellers. And people are going to continue to get conned until they find out that the candidates are connected with the Rockefellers. Let's discuss the next strategy of the Rockefellers, and that is building your own opposition. Probably the most incredible thing about the Rockefeller family is that it has had a connection, a very close connection, for over 50 years with the Soviet Union. Now, in the minds of the average person, there is no greater enemies than the Rockefellers and the Soviets. After all, much of the communist propaganda over the past 50 years has been aimed at the idea that the whole thrust of world communism is to destroy the Rockefellers so that the Rockefellers' wealth can be redistributed among the poor people of the world. If that is true, the Rockefellers have been acting very strangely. Now, the research that I relied upon for the chapter I did in the book on the Rockefellers and the communists comes from Professor Anthony Sutton, who for years was a researcher for the Hoover Institute for War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University, who devoted over 10 years to studying the links between Western technology and the growth of the Soviet Union. He's put out several books on this. Many of them are pretty academic and a little difficult to read, and I have summarized them. It's interesting. Sutton has never been challenged. His books just don't get reviewed. But nobody has challenged his information. He did a three-volume history called Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, in which he discovered, using mostly State Department files, but he found that practically everything that is modern in the Soviet Union comes from the West. And in particular, the really shocking thing, the incredible thing, is the Soviet military-industrial complex was built up virtually entirely out of the West, primarily by the United States, mainly by the Rockefellers. Going back, as he showed in his book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, the Rockefellers were even involved in putting up money for the communist takeover of the Soviet Union in 1917. Now, you have to ask yourself, why would the Rockefellers, over the past 50 years and continually even more strongly today, for instance, most of you are probably aware that the largest truck factory in the world is being built at the Kama River project in the Soviet Union, largest truck factory in the world. It's being financed jointly by the Rockefellers and the United States government. You know, trucks are absolutely a necessity in modern warfare. And of course, truck factories also produce tanks. Rockefellers even have an office in the Soviet Union now at 10 Karl Marx Plaza. You know, they got the best address in town. When you look at the research, you find that for over 50 years, the Rockefellers have been closely connected with the communists, their alleged blood enemies. Why? Well, I think you have to conclude either the Rockefellers are very dumb or they're very smart. Maybe they just build up their enemy because they're stupid. Or maybe they're smart. Maybe they're building up an enemy because they have a long-term goal. That long-term goal is to merge the countries of the world into a world government. The Rockefellers call it the New World Order. If you listen to Henry Kissinger, all of the time he is talking about the New World Order. Well, you go out on the street, walk up to somebody and say, hey, Charlie, what do you think the New World Order is? And he'll give you a funny look and say, well, is that new sandwich they have down at McDonald's? Here are these people, they keep using this phrase over and over and over again, New World Order. Nelson Rockefeller even wrote a book about it called The Future of Federalism. Wrote it about 15 years ago, but they've reprinted it now, brought it out again, new edition since he became vice president, New World Order. Well, why would the Rockefellers want a world government? Very simple, going back to the same reason they want a monopoly of government in this country. They want to centralize everything. Because when you centralize something, if you sit at the apex of the pyramid of centralized government, you control everything. Remember we said that the Rockefellers own businesses in 125 countries around the world? Well, think of all the politicians they have to deal with when you're in business in 125 different countries. That's why they want to merge all the countries into one world government, which they can control from the apex. Then they only have to control one guy. They don't have to control 125 separate political systems. Well, how do you get people to go for a world government? You have to bring about a crisis. Under normal circumstances, there is no motivation for the American people to go along with the merging of the United States into being just another country in a world government, just as California is a state in the United States. People say, well, I think that sounds a little dangerous. I don't think we ought to go along with it. There are two things that would push the people into accepting a world government. One is the threat of war. You want to know why the Rockefellers systematically have created the military-industrial complex of the Soviet Union? To create the threat of a war. So there will be a reason for us to say, well, we better go into a world government to bring about peace. The other factor which could bring about the acceptance of a world government, of course, is a worldwide depression. Or the threat of war during a depression, and people would say, well, we'll accept anything that might work. So in other words, you create a problem, and then you come along to solve the problem. You create the problem of the Soviet Union, and then you offer the New World Order as the answer to the problem. Now think about this for a minute. We've had the Soviet Union for some 50 years running around screaming. It's just like if I go out in the street and I say, when I get my hands on a gun, I am going to shoot Joe Doakes. I'm going to blow his brains out. I hate that guy. I'm going to decapitate him as soon as I get my hands on a gun. And then we find out that Joe Doakes is providing me with a cylinder, a barrel, a trigger, a sight, grips, and he's giving me the gun. Why is he doing this? Again, you got to get back. Either Joe Doakes is either very stupid, or all this screaming and yelling that I've been doing is a lot of showbiz, and he and I are really working together, and I am not going to shoot him. But he has ulterior motives. And I submit the only thing that makes sense in this constant building of the Soviet military-industrial complex by the Rockefellers is that the Rockefellers, I don't think, are stupid. I don't think they got to be multi-billionaires by being dumb. And we know that the Soviet Union would not exist as a threat in the world today if it were not for the Rockefellers. I just don't think they're stupid enough to get themselves shot. Now, the obvious question, and I'm asked this at every Q&A, and it's an excellent question, is, well, what's going to keep the Soviets, after they've given them the gun, from pulling the trigger? Well, I can't give you a for sure answer on that, except I don't think the Rockefellers are going to give them any bullets. I don't think the Rockefellers are stupid enough to commit suicide. I think they have either some ultimate form of control within the Soviet Union or an ultimate defense system, so that while we will be threatened with war, we will have atomic blackmail, and it will be used as a lever for more and more surrenders all around the world. But I don't think it's ever going to be consummated. I think it will be used as the excuse for us to say, yes, give us the world government. We will merge our country with that of the Soviet Union, and we will avoid the Holocaust. To me, that's the only reason that makes sense why the Rockefellers would do what they are doing and what they have done for a period of over 50 years. Now, it's interesting, when in 1953, there was a congressional committee to investigate foundations. The guy that was in charge of the investigation was a fellow named Norman Dodd, who later became a friend of mine. And he told me how just prior to this investigation, he'd received the appointment. He went and sat down with the head of the Ford Foundation. And in a conversation with this guy, Norman Dodd asked him why they made all of these grants that promoted socialism. And the president of the Ford Foundation said to Norman Dodd, we are doing it so that we can build the United States to the point where it can comfortably be merged with the economy of the Soviet Union. That was everything that the Ford Foundation was doing, and the Ford Foundation is controlled by the Rockefellers. Everything was being done to bring about this great merger where eventually the United States and the Soviet Union will be merged. It was interesting, and he added to Dodd, he said, and we have been doing this for many years, all under orders from the White House. And Norm Dodd will tell you when they got into investigating at the highest levels this building up of the great merger, all of a sudden, the investigation was shut off, and it was shut off by the White House. So the Rockefellers are involved in this movement for world government. It is the most important issue. You know, you and I can sit and we can argue about what do we do with Social Security. And we can argue about all kinds of different issues. But there are two issues that if we lose, make every other issue academic. That is the defense issue and the world government issue. and they're closely tied because obviously the weakening of our defenses is going to be used as the reason why we must accept the great merger. If we lose that one, we've lost the whole ball game. The gentleman that brought me up here tonight was telling me about the local congressman here who is very sound on every issue except one. He is the sponsor of the Atlantic Union Bill, one of the sponsors. Well, that's like saying, gee, a guy is a wonderful man. He gives to his church. He takes care of his children. He's nice to his wife. He has just one fault. He murders people. And we ought to overlook that one little flaw in his character because he does so many other good things. If we are submerged into a world government, then every other issue we argue about becomes totally academic. Now, in this country, domestic issues the establishment can't hide because we bump into them every day. Walter Crankcase cannot come on television tonight and say, folks, I have wonderful news. Inflation has been laid to rest. We have no more inflation. He can't do that. Why? Well, you were just down at the market, and you know what's a lie. The price of everything is up. Domestic issues, sure, they try and confuse you, but they have to admit that the issue exists. But you get into world government and defense issues, and the vast majority of the American people are totally at the mercy of the mass media for their opinions in that field. And you'll never hear Walter Crankcase come on and talk to you about world government. Never, never, ever, until it's done. He never talks about the Atlantic Union movement. The number one issue in every congressional race this year should be world government. It's not an issue, is it? Because there's not one American in 500 that even realizes it's a possibility. Because we're totally dependent upon the media. Now, the Rockefellers don't totally control the media. Well, they control ABC, NBC, CBS, New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times. But they don't control everything. They only want to control about 90%. They don't use any total instrumentalities, no 100% instrumentalities, no all-black instrumentalities. They want things to be dark gray. I can go out and I can get interviewed on a lot of television shows, a lot of radio shows, a lot of little independents. They don't want 100% control. 95%? That's what they want. They want to give the appearance that it is open and free and that opposition is allowed. So they will allow some. But you can't go on the Today Show, any kind of nationwide thing, and talk about this kind of stuff. Even a lot of the local guys are afraid. That's why the Rockefellers don't have to go around and buy up every radio and television station in the country. I've talked to a lot of these guys that are managers or owners of small radio and television stations. And they'll tell you very frankly, look, I'd like to put you on. You get a lot of listeners. You're controversial. Some of them will say they agree with you. Some of them just think that you ought to be able to speak like anybody else. But then they'll say, look, I never heard of any radio or television station not getting their FCC license renewed because they were too liberal. But I sure know of some that didn't get it renewed because they were too conservative. And I've got a $125,000 investment in this station, and I can't take a chance. See, the Rockefellers don't have to go around and buy up all the stations. They just have to control the guy at the top of the Federal Communications Commission. See, When you centralize control, and the Rockefellers are for every form of centralization in every field you can think of, when you control the apex of the power pyramid under centralized control, you get de facto control of everything. Even things that the Rockefellers promote, like supposed to help local government by federal grants. We're gonna preserve local government by federal grants. Well, that's just a contradiction in terms, isn't it? Local government has got to go along to get the federal grant. So even some of the things that are done that are supposed to be decentralization, reality or centralization. The Rockefellers don't want to control all of the media. They want to control most of the media most of the time. We have to be our own mass media. That's our only out. You guys can write letters to ABC, NBC, and CBS till you know where freezes over, and they're never going to change their policies. They're never going to give you a fair shake. Not if you want to talk about world government. Oh, you can go on and you can talk about wasteful government spending and that kind of stuff. That's not a survival issue, at least not in the short run. World government is. We have to be our own mass media. Now, that's frankly the reason that I wrote this book. The book is a book to show people that we are dealing with an organization here. If we could get 8 or 10 million copies of that book out, and I realize what I'm saying is very self-serving because I'm the author, but if we could and get people to read that book, we could break the hold that the Rockefellers have over both the political parties. How could you ever get that many books out? Well, I don't think there's any fairy godmother that's going to come along on a white horse and lay $8 million on me and tell me to go deliver books to people. Would be nice, but it's not going to happen. That book is going to get massively distributed. You people are going to have to do it. And here is how I think you should do it. Don't give books away. Why? Well, we've all have limitations as to how much we can spend. We're all on a budget, and inflation has made things very tight. There's just so much money you can afford to spend on something like this. If you will buy bulk quantities of books and just make up your mind that it's going to be a project that you're going to take on, that you're going to be a truth pusher, and you're going to go get other people to be truth junkies, get them hooked, and make pushers out of them, then you can start a geometric progression. And don't give the books away. Anybody can afford to buy a book for $1 or $2. If you buy them in quantity and you're paying $1 for them and you sell half of them for $2, for every one you sell, you can give another one away. I realize there's some people that because of a personal relationship, you can't really say, give me a buck. But most of them you can. And if you make this thing self-funding, then there is no limit to how many books you can get out. But if you go out and you say, well, I can afford to buy 10 books and I'll go give those 10 books away and then I'll quit, then that's where it stops because you can't afford anymore. Freedom isn't free and people can afford to pay a buck or two to find out what the heck is going on in this country. They live here too. So remember this, people are more likely to read the book if they paid for it than if you just gave it to them. Now if you're clever, you'll come up with gimmicks like, say, look, take this book and I want you to read 3 chapters tonight and tomorrow either give me a buck or give me the book back. You know, a little salesmanship in there isn't going to hurt anything. But if you want to break the Rockefeller control, that's the way it has to be done. It has to be done by the grassroots because nobody's going to save us but us. Now, I'm going to close with a 2-minute pitch for the John Birch Society, which I've been a member of since 1964. It turned me around from being the liberal that I was when I got out of college. Look, I can stand up here. I could give you all kinds of reasons you ought to join. But let me put it this way to you, very quickly. If you read this book, you will know that the Rockefellers, as I said in the beginning, are one, organized, and two, they have a plan. They've also got a lot of momentum, and they got a lot of money to carry the plan out with. It's just common sense. If these people are organized, then we better organize. And in your heart, you know that if you don't become part of the organization to stop these people, you're doing just the same thing as watching somebody kidnap a child in front of you. Except this one is going to be you and your own child. The other side is organized. We have to be organized too. There's an old saying that when evil men conspire, good men must organize. Now, you can think of 89 different rationalizations why you can do more good on the outside and why you shouldn't join the John Birch Society. But deep down in your heart, you all know it gets right down to whether you have the guts to get out on the firing line where the battle's being fought or not. It's simply a matter of conscience. And if you can go home tonight and you can come up with any reason, any logical reason of why the Rockefellers can be stopped if we don't organize, then don't join. But if it makes sense to you that we have to match with numbers of people and with dedication what they are doing with a few people in high places and lots of money, if that makes sense to you, then you should talk to the gentleman here about joining with us in the John Birch Society to try to keep this country from becoming submerged in a dictatorial world government. Now, I'm a great believer in the old adage that the mind can only absorb what the fanny can endure. And I've kind of wandered on here tonight, and I apologize for that. I hope that I have imparted some information that you found interesting. After we have a few announcements, I'll be back to try to answer any questions that you have. And I appreciate you coming out tonight and sitting in here. I know it's very warm. You've been a great audience, and I hope we'll see you again. Thank you very much.